Your neighborhood gives me the creeps. Your neighborhood gives me the creeps. Ooh, your neighborhood gives me the creeps.
Welcome all you spooks and kooks to Weird Chicago Radio Season 2, brought to you by Weird Chicago Ghost Tours, www.weirdchicago.com.
Your neighborhood gives me the creeps. Your neighborhood gives me the creeps.
Hi, this is Weird Chicago Radio Season 2. This is Adam.
Hey, this is Ken Melvoin Burke, psychic detective.
Alright, we are actually on a quest today to find the second H.H. Holmes murder castle, the existence of which we have turned up in our research. We probably do more historical research than any other ghost investigation team in the state, I would say. What did you say?
I'd say the Midwest.
Okay. And I practically live in the newspaper archives these days. But anyway, Ken, why don't you tell the folks about H.H. Holmes and his first murder castle?
Well, first of all, what we're going to be talking about today has really nothing to do with ghosts. It's more about a serial killer. Now, originally, there was a man who was born in New Hampshire by the name of Hurt Webster Mudgett. At the age of 19, Mudgett changed his name and ended up switching it to Howard Henry Holmes, or H.H. Holmes, as he went by. Now, this guy was not only somebody who ended up becoming a serial killer, but he also invented the insurance scam, believe it or not.
He was an early practitioner of it, at the very least.
Now, as a child, he was known to torture animals, and he was very cruel to other children. About the only thing that was a positive note about him was that he was an incredibly good student and a very bright boy. His father was a postmaster and a bit of an alcoholic. He had sort of instilled good study ethics into Herbert when he was a very, very young lad, but he was really a sociopath. He didn't really look at killing somebody, having sex with them first, taking an insurance policy out in their name, and then collecting the insurance, but then he would take the corpse, he would strip the flesh off from it, and then he would have the skeleton articulated, and then resell the skeleton after the entire thing was done. Now, he started doing this when he entered medical school at the University of Michigan at the age of 19, when he changed his name to H.H. Holmes. Now, as you hear some of the background noise, we are currently in the Wicker Park neighborhood of the movie of the same name. Now, primarily this neighborhood today is filled with yuppie scumbags and wannabe scenesters. But back in the 1890s, this is one of the places where Holmes, when he eventually had moved to Chicago, started a side business as a glass-blowing business. Now, although we were calling it a murder castle, there was really only one murder castle. The place we're going to be going to today was the site of a former Holmes factory where he had a glass-blowing business out of, and it is the place where he had a house directly behind it, kind of a ramshackle house, but we'll be talking about that in a little bit.
Right.
Now, in my opinion, Holmes was the most prolific serial killer in United States history. I think that he realistically exceeded well over 200 victims in his time, which included men, women, and children. Because he had a background in medicine, starting from an early age, he would take wounded and sick animals, or even some healthy animals, and he would start by holding them down, knocking them out, and dissecting them. And he didn't really see anything wrong with this. Then he extended it to people. Now, at his time at the University of Michigan, the first time that somebody really knew something fishy was going on was when he was dragging a corpse across the campus in Ann Arbor. He was actually stopped by a security guard, and the security guard asked him, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm taking my young woman to make love to her, you fool. Leave us alone, you idiot." And the guy did. Just left him alone. Now, this is very typical of Holmes, who was not only confident, he was extremely overconfident, so much so that he got away with things that nobody else could even fathom or consider. One of the things Adam and I were talking about a little while ago was just that at that time, nobody really thought that there would be such a thing as a serial killer.
Right,
really.
Right. They assumed if he killed somebody, he must have had some
a motive,
money to give.
A motive or a
yeah,
profit
there must
or
have been
something.
A real motive.
Holmes was interested in seeing how far the human body could be tortured. I mean, he did everything from, like, stretching people on a rack to amputations
dissection
to laying the skin off them,
alive.
Dissection while
yeah.
they're still alive. A whole variety of different things. Now, eventually Holmes ended up moving to the Chicago area, and during the Columbian Exposition, the World's Fair of 1893, he built his murder castle, which if you've ever read the book Devil in the White City by Eric Larson, that book is about a combination of things, which include the World's Fair, the architects Burnham and Root, who had much to do with the design of what was called the White City, or the World's Fair during the Columbian Exposition of 1893, and about the serial killer H.H. Holmes. Now, Holmes had originally moved to Chicago, and around 1885, I believe, is when he had first moved here. And around 1891, he had taken over as a pharmacist for Dr. Mrs. Holden. Mrs. Holden owned a pharmacy at the corner of 63rd and Wallace. It was between Wallace and Lowe on 63rd. And as H.H. had taken over there, he wasn't what you'd call an incredibly good-looking guy, but he had piercing eyes, he had very long, nimble fingers, and he was seen pouring the chemicals and making the tinctures behind the counter of the pharmacy. And he was quite popular with the ladies of the neighborhood. So Mrs. Holden's pharmacy got to be more and more and more popular. Now, Mr. Holden, or Dr. Holden rather, was sick the majority of the time that he was there, and suddenly had died of a mysterious cause that we're not sure whether it was just the escalation of the disease he already had or the possibility that Holmes had actually killed him. Shortly after that, H.H. had taken over not only the pharmacy position, which was what anybody who was a doctor could have done to make more money, believe it or not. Pharmacists probably made more than actual physicians did, because physicians weren't guaranteed to get paid, but a pharmacist was almost guaranteed to have not only the line of pharmacy stuff that he had, whether it's the tinctures, the potions, the salves, but he could also sell things like jewelry and dry goods and, you know, what have you, whatever would be inside. And eventually they ended up adding like soda fountains and candy stores into many of these places. Now, when Holmes had become indispensable at the Holden Pharmacy, he had been answering questions about the disappearance of Mrs. Holden. Suddenly she just stopped coming around and people were wondering where she was. His explanation for this was that she sold the pharmacy to him and had mysteriously moved to California. Now, we know that this was one of his very first murders there. Shortly after this, there was a man named Ned Connor, who Holmes had hired as a jewelry maker. He was a watch repairman. Him and his wife, Julia, and their young daughter, Pearl, had moved in to the area, and Julia and Holmes started a relationship with one another. As they became closer, Ned Connor saw that this was occurring and became very concerned, because he was not a confident man. He was not a charismatic man. He was a guy that knew how to make watches, and he was about as boring as watching the Reagans. And that, can I say on our broadcast?
I'll just edit it out.
Okay, edit that out. So, needless to say, Julia Connor was much more interested, in fact, thought that Holmes was going to marry her because he said he would. Now, she had actually become pregnant with Holmes' child, and eventually she would actually die during what he claimed later was a botched abortion. What we know, though, is that they actually found Julia's dress in the basement of the murder castle, and to my knowledge, how abortions are performed usually go under the dress, Adam,
yeah,
right? Not
right.
Through the dress,
right.
Which is what they had found, was bloodstains going through the fabric itself. Pretty soon, he found that there was a piece of land for sale across the street from the pharmacy, and he decided that he was going to not only buy that land, but he was going to sell the original pharmacy to Ned Connor. Now, one of the other things that Holmes was famous for was he was a deadbeat, and he was racking up all sorts of debts, getting all sorts of people supplying him with stuff, and his basically a major way for him to make money was just not to pay them. So what he had done was he had tricked Ned Connor into taking not only the lease of the building, but included that all the debt that he had accrued would then be on Ned's shoulders, essentially. He sold Ned the pharmacy, and then what he didn't tell Ned was that he was going to build another pharmacy directly across the street. So all the women that were there to come see H.H. Holmes, not Ned Connor, were very interested in going to his pharmacy directly across the street, and it actually ended up bankrupting poor Ned Connor, who then had his wife and his daughter move in with H.H. Holmes. Pretty soon, it was, I believe, Christmas of 1892, I want to say, and that's when both Julia and young Pearl disappeared on Christmas. One of the people that was a neighbor of theirs had made a note that young Pearl was going to be coming to their house on Christmas Day itself. And when and they made such a big deal about this because they helped set up the Christmas tree, Julia and Pearl did, and Pearl was so excited that they really were very much expecting them. So suddenly when they didn't show up and they talked to Holmes about it and he said that they had just kind of went off on their own to Detroit, they had thought that was a wee bit odd. Next year, 1893, Holmes builds his murder castle. Now, he actually was the architect for this building. He would hire people that would supply materials. He would hire workmen to work on the building, and then he wouldn't pay them. So he had nobody that was consistently there the entire time, so it was quite easy for him to build this in a quite cheap manner. And he had accrued quite a bit of cash as of this point because he had done a number of insurance scams starting off in his early days at University of Michigan by taking a dead body that he would actually steal from a cemetery. Grave robbing was a common occurrence by medical students at that time. In fact, many times they actually had school-sponsored grave robbing trips,
right,
because they had a huge problem having
medical schools and hospitals were not picky about where the cadavers came
from. Right, exactly.
It was a kind of a no-questions-asked policy.
And it was a similar no-questions-asked policy with where you got these things from. Now, so Holmes, with insurance companies, rather, they didn't really question where the dead bodies came from. Insurance inspectors weren't nearly as fastidious as they are today. So one of the things that Holmes was able to do was take an insurance policy out on a mysterious family member, and you have to keep in mind there wasn't real good documentation or anything of that sort at the time. So he would take an insurance policy out, he would steal a corpse, and then he would say that his relative died in this terrible accident, produce the corpse, and walk away with $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 cash. And this is something that he did time and time again. Then he would get the body back after it had been interred, strip the flesh off it, articulate it, and then resell it to a medical school, to a hospital, what have you. So, 1893, World's Fair. You have to imagine what Chicago was like at that time. It was ripe for the picking for a con artist and a sociopath like H.H. Holmes. People were coming from all over the world to come here to the World's Fair. It was huge. It was, a combination between Disneyland and, some of the best fairgrounds and, everything in the Super Bowl all together.
Yeah, to give an idea of what a big deal this was, there were about 27 million paid admissions to the World's Fair. And this is at a time when the population of the United States was only about 65 million.
So, just to give you an idea, that's, nearly half the country had,
yeah, the equivalent of about half the country
would have come here at that point. Now, many people in the rural areas had a hard time getting jobs. And one of the things that Holmes decided to do was start to take out advertisements in Midwestern newspapers all over the place. He would start by saying that he had a variety of jobs that you could apply for. He would only hire women when he was to do this. And as they came in, he would first be assured that they told nobody that they were actually coming here. And to further assure himself, he would usually, within 48 hours, have sex with the girl that he had brought here. He would get her to marry him, take an insurance policy out in their name, torture them just to assure that there wasn't any people that knew of their current whereabouts, kill them, collect the insurance policy, and then again, articulate the skeleton, sell it off. Now, his tortures had extended in the basement of the murder castle. Now, this murder castle had three floors and a sub-basement. Top floor was Holmes' personal residence. Second floor was where he rented out to all the young ladies that would come for the Columbian Exposition. And the bottom level was retail stores, which consisted of a candy store, his drug store, the jewelry making shop, and I'm trying to remember, is there anything else that you
that's,
remember?
That's the only ones I can remember.
Yeah, I think that was pretty much it. So he had quite a few different folks that wanted to come and work for him. So it wasn't a trouble at all to get these girls here. Furthermore, with 27 million people over the course of a year coming to Chicago, there was a lot of people missing. And to be honest, the police were so busy in other avenues, they didn't really have time to look for, you know, young Doris Mayfield from Dubuque, Iowa, who had come to the big city of Chicago and, you know what, probably just ended up getting lost somewhere in the city.
Because, yeah, hundreds of people got
this is at a time when there has never been a serial killer up to this point. This is one of the reasons why I personally believe that Holmes was the largest serial killer in our nation's history, because there was nobody there to stop him, nobody to track him, and he thought himself as a godlike figure who was unstoppable. He had murdered a variety of different people, which not only included women, but children, as he poisoned young Pearl Connor. He, with the Peitzel children, Ben Peitzel was probably his only accomplice, and he had eventually ended up betraying Ben Peitzel and murdering his three children.
Let's pause here. We're getting pretty close to our destination, so we're going to just kind of pause here and finish off the story before we go up and do our detective work. There's a nice out of the way place to pause and keep talking.
No, we still actually got to pause.
Oh, okay. We got to get under the expressway for one thing.
So, Holmes had killed a variety of different people. Are we still rolling?
Yeah, we're still rolling. Okay, let's just keep doing.
He had killed so many folks and had disposed of their bodies. One of the things that he didn't want to do, though, is first of all, he had a couple of weird phobias himself. He was deathly afraid of anybody touching and doing anything to his dead body. He had actually included it in his last will and testament for them to bury him in 2 tons of cement. Now, eventually, he had done so many scams and was a deadbeat in so many different places that the Pinkerton Detective Agency was called in. Now, the funny thing was, you would think that, oh, it would be, you know, for a murder or for torturing a small child.
Let's go up to Seeley Avenue. That's where it is. It should be right up
here.
Yeah,
but it's way over that way.
Oh, true. Yeah, it's got to go over
there. We can go that way. That's fine.
No, I don't know if that's going to get cut off by the Kennedy over there.
It will get cut off by the Kennedy.
Okay, let's just keep walking. Okay, we're doing some detective work here. So, normally there's nothing between Damon and Hoyne, but what we're looking for is a street between those two. Okay, go on, Ken.
Sure. And what had happened was that Holmes had tortured numerous people, but the thing that actually got him caught was a horse swindle that he had tried to do when he had started a relationship with a girl by the name of Minnie Williams. Minnie Williams was a very plain woman that he had met when he was a teacher in Boston many years before. He had told her that his name was Harry Gordon, and that was one of his 23 aliases that we actually know about. He had always kept himself close, but would write her inconsistently, so he kind of kept her strung along, if you will.
Yeah.
And she eventually found out he was in Chicago, but he insisted that when she had ended up moving here, that she called him H.H., which was really mysterious because she called him her Harry or Gordon, either one. Now, when she had moved here, shortly afterwards, she had talked to her sister about moving here as well. Her sister and her were both heiresses to a Texas real estate fortune. And one of the things that was kind of interesting is that her sister might have had a little bit more common sense than she did. So she was very skeptical at all that H.H. was what he appeared to be. Until that is that she arrived in Chicago as his personal treat. He actually paid for her ticket here, was going to show her the World's Fair, give her a place to stay, and let her meet him. Now, he seemed as though he was very much in love with her sister, Minnie. Just adored her, fawned upon her, spent oodles of cash on her. When Annie Williams had arrived, they went to the World's Fair together, spent an entire day. He bought food and treats and lemonade, and eventually she saw the charisma and the charm that her sister had seen in him. She also started to get attracted to him. Now, this is something that would end up sort of being a downfall of H.H. Holmes. The Williams sisters were, as any siblings are, had a kind of a sibling rivalry of sorts.
Right.
And when Minnie noticed that Annie had an undue attraction to H.H., it was she, unlike the book stated, not H.H. Holmes that killed Annie Williams. In fact, we're pretty sure that she bashed her head in down by Lake Michigan
with
a chair.
Minnie was the one
who
killed her.
Right, Minnie killed her.
We also assumed that Minnie probably knew what was going on in that hotel.
And she was an accomplice. Eventually, there was another woman by the name of, what was her name again? The girl from Indiana.
Is that Emily?
No, not Emily Sigrun, the other one.
Oh, jeez. Is it Lizzie? We don't have our cheat sheets on us. We're just walking.
By the way, we're doing this from memory, guys. So
right.
We're
just walking through the
so
frozen
memory.
Cold.
Here's
the railroad tracks right here. That's the that trestle going over right up there.
No, that's the highway.
No, the next to that. These,
we're going this way. We're going to go up a block. And
okay,
left.
Then we'll take a left.
So
okay,
we're doing this all the way from memory, guys. Just to let you know, I just got done doing the biography of H.H. Holmes on the Biography Channel, and Adam just found some of the most groundbreaking research that I think anybody has ever discovered about H.H. Holmes with help from our other partner, Troy Taylor.
Right.
So, anyways, they had the three people. It was Minnie Williams, H.H. Holmes, and the woman who was a prostitute from Indiana who also had a real estate fortune, Georgiana Yokes.
That's the one.
So it was Georgiana Yokes. It had gone first to St. Louis, then to Texas. And the thing that got them busted was that they decided to do a horse swindle, put a train load of horses, brought them up to St. Louis, and ended up, you know, swindling the people in Texas. Now, eventually, it was the Pinkerton Detective Agency that would end up, it was Detective Frank Dyer that ended up actually catching H.H. Holmes and had tracked him down through a series of events. And it was this horse swindle that actually caused them to get caught. Now, over time, Holmes had found out that there was the Pinkertons that were coming after him. He had left Chicago with Ben Pitzel's wife and three children, traveled around, and would switch houses every day or so. He then sent Carrie Pitzel, who was Ben Pitzel's wife, off to New York City, and he remained in charge of the three Pitzel children, who he then tortured and killed in a variety of different ways. Now, he started with young Harry Pitzel by taking him and he shoved him into an oven where he was burned alive, and that was just outside of Indianapolis, Indiana. Then they went to Detroit, Philadelphia, back to Indianapolis, not in the suburbs, but in the city itself, and then eventually to Toronto, where he decided that, and by the way, when he was in Detroit, I don't know if you read about this, he actually, I think it was young Lucy Pitzel, he had actually amputated her feet.
Yeah.
She had club feet, and he didn't want to be recognized with a child who was very distinguishable, so he actually amputated her feet. Now, he decided to tell them they were going to play a game of hide-and-seek when they were on 16 Victor Street in Toronto, Canada, and when they hid inside of a trunk, he slipped a hose in and gassed them. And it was the murder of these children that actually is the thing that got him caught and got the Pinkertons. That's what actually got him convicted.
Right.
Was that particular crime. In fact, Holmes, during the trial, fired his attorney, took over his own defense. He had got it so that it was inadmissible for the murder of the children to be included in the trial and almost got away with it.
Right.
That's one of the things that they had found out about. I think we need to. We'll go up here.
We
we'll
need
take
to go up here and take a left. Yeah, this is. Yeah, there's, that's.
This is what I was talking about. I don't think it goes through.
Right. It doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't go through. It stops at the interstate. But it's somewhere in that triangle. It goes as far as the railroad tracks.
There's no here. It's going to be the one that we're looking for. One of the other things is that on October, or it was like I think it was Halloween Day of 1895, is when they started the trial of H.H. Holmes. The jury took maybe an hour to decide that he was guilty, although he was very charismatic and he was very intelligent about his defense. They knew that this guy was guilty. They knew he was a con artist. Convicted him quite fast. He was convicted, and he was actually stunned when the judge and jury read the verdict. Now, he was sentenced to die, and he was killed. Then they buried him in one tub of cement. Now, this is where it gets even more strange, because shortly after he was killed, the H.H. Holmes curse, as it would end up being called, started to take effect. Now, it started with the time when he was being hung. Now, as he was on the hangman's noose, H.H. Holmes' last words, and keep in mind this is shortly after Jack the Ripper had done his terrible thing in Whitechapel, his last words were, "I am Jack the," and then they hung him. At that exact moment, a lightning bolt flashed across the sky, although there was not a cloud in the sky at the time, and then the neck of H.H. Holmes was broken, although his heart kept beating. The rope embedded nearly an inch into his flesh, and his heart beat for 15 minutes beyond the time he should have died.
Right.
Then they buried him in 2 tons of cement, and then a whole variety of mysterious things started happening to the judge, to the jury foreman, to the Catholic priest that gave him last rites, to other members of the jury, to people that were involved in testifying against him. Every one of them died of either electrical shocks or mysterious illnesses. The last, most mysterious thing about H.H. Holmes was that there was a fire that broke out in the insurance company that was actually prosecuting him the majority of the time, and everything in the insurance company burned down except for two items, and that was the file on all the crimes that H.H. Holmes had done against this insurance agency and a photograph of H.H. Holmes. Everything else burned to the ground. Now, Adam's going to take over and talk to you about what we're doing here on Seeley Street looking for the house where Holmes very well might have hid some of the bodies.
Right. But here's the thing. There is a minor character in the story. He's mentioned very off the cuff and occasionally in a couple of the books about H.H. Holmes. A man by the name of Patrick Quinlan. He was the janitor at what has come to be known as the H.H. Holmes Murder Castle. And in July and August of 1895, there was a lot of furor about this in the newspapers. The story was just starting to break. It was headlines every day. And at the time, the police were saying that Patrick Quinlan was just as guilty as H.H. Holmes. They said that he had been his accomplice the entire time and held him in custody for quite a while. Now, we're not entirely sure how much he might have known. We have to assume today that he must have known what was going on, unless he was remarkably stupid. About the best I can figure out from my dealings is that he had probably been working with Holmes out of a sense of fear. He knew what kind of a guy Holmes was. Holmes had killed his girlfriend, in fact. So he was probably continuing to work with him just because he was afraid not to. Now, in mid-August of 1895, there was a big fire at the murder castle. Quite possibly it was actually started by Patrick Quinlan. Most places actually say that the building actually burned down at the time. It actually was still standing up through the 1930s. But anyway, what happened was yesterday, Troy Taylor, one of our partner, sent me this email that he'd been given. It was a small news article from right a couple of days after the murder castle burned.
All right,
we're going to make like Theodore Roosevelt and charge the hill. Okay, we're charging up a hill to some railroad tracks here. But Troy sent me a news article saying that... okay, sorry, it's kind of a rough going here. He had sent me a news article stating that they had found another murder castle. It was a small factory where 65 Sobieski Street ought to be. It had been it was full of newspaper, full of pieces of paper with Patrick Quinlan's signature on it. The neighbors all said that H.H. Holmes was the owner based on his picture. And they thought that it was a glass blowing and vending place, but they thought he might have actually done some of his cremation there. Now, we had to look at some old maps. There hasn't been a Sobieski Street in the city since 1896. But what it is it's a very short, like, quarter-mile strip of what is now called Seeley Avenue near Fullerton, just north of Wicker Park. So, that's where we are right now. We have a bare-bones description that the thing was a small factory that looked fairly cheaply built, about 20 feet by 150 feet.
And we're standing on a railroad trestle on all sorts of little rocks, and it's 20 below with the wind chill right now.
Yes.
To give you guys an idea.
So if we freeze to death,
how far did Adam and I go to yeah, make you people happy?
Yeah, to try to find if we can. Since nobody seems to have known anything about this, this story was actually carried in several small newspapers and the New York Times that they had found this other building, but that's the only mention of it that ever came up in the press. So we've assumed that it's probably gone today, but we were able to pinpoint the approximate location. You think this is the building?
Yeah, this would be where it would be at. This is the north and west side.
But is this, is it the right dimensions, do you think?
In fact, some of this structure here looks like it may have been part of, it could have been, I can't tell if the top of this building was at one time.
Yeah. It does look like quite a bit of this. We are next to what looks like an old factory here. I think it might be a little too large.
It's a tool and die place now.
Yeah. Now, we had to do a little bit of detective work to figure out exactly where it was. The main clue is that it was where the Northwest Line Railroad crossed Roby Avenue, just northwest of that. Roby was what they called what is now called Damon Street back then, so we were able to pinpoint that on the map. Yeah, it's Damon now. Sorry. Well, if we freeze to death out here or fall to our deaths down this hill, well, you'll know that H.H. Holmes has claimed two more victims posthumously. Now, the end of the story of Quinlan is that the police arrested him, interrogated him for a few weeks, and decided that they didn't have enough evidence on him and let him go. A couple of years later, he and his wife tried to sue for false imprisonment, but they weren't successful at it. In 1913, about 19 years after everything, he actually was the last person associated with Holmes to die mysteriously. It wasn't really mysterious. For the rest of his life, he had been plagued with nightmares and hallucinations. Train, oh great. nightmares and hallucinations, and then one day he paused for the train.
Holy crap.
Okay. Yeah, that's really, really cold. But one day he pulled out a piece of paper and wrote, "I could not sleep," and then committed suicide by taking poison.
Speaking of which, got a sort of an odd coincidence. Have you heard, Adam, recently what is the number one death cause of Americans as of this point?
What is it?
Poisonings have just overtaken auto accidents.
Really?
Yeah. Primarily it's people mixing things like Vicodin and tequila, which is something I'm fond of, by the way.
Right.
I have yet to die from doing
so,
it. But don't do that,
accidental
kids,
poisonings.
By the way. I never recommend taking Vicodin and tequila together, unless you're me.
All right, say no to drugs, kids. If you're a psychic like Ken, you'll know ahead of time if it'll kill you or not.
That's right. But my superpowers only work for cash, and fortunately I can afford me now. And it looks like we got another train.
Yeah, we got another train coming. We're going to be charging back down the hill to check out this building a little more. See if this might have actually been... This does certainly look like it. Yeah.
Dollar store groceries on one side.
No, this
the
is,
car
this
wash is
yeah.
over there, and then it's like a tool and die place up front.
Right. They said that at the time it actually fronted a, actually, I'm wondering if maybe it's one of these ones over here also. Because they also said it was attached to a 2.5-story house. Okay, sorry about that. I accidentally pushed stop in the process of trying to get down this hill safely, which frankly ain't gonna happen. I'm gonna be risking my life one way or the other. Just run. I got too much stuff that I'm carrying. I'm kind of crawling down crab-like here. I'm kind of starting to feel like Gollum. Oh, jeez, now my foot's stuck. Okay, alright.
You look beautiful, Adam.
Thanks. Me and my snowy ass. Okay, before we decide for sure it was this building, I want to check out some of these ones over here.
That'd be the wrong side of the street, though.
No, they say it was fronting nothing but the railroad track, which is right about where this would be.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is yeah.
This
it looks like also,
it.
Also yes, there have certainly been some.
Because it'd be the east side.
Yeah.
This is north and west.
There have also certainly been some additions put onto this building before.
It looks like it may have been like an old house at one point. There was a factory that was built around it. It's a
right.
very odd structure.
True.
And we'll have to come in during business hours at some point and maybe see if we can talk to some of the people here.
Yeah.
And see if we have any reported.
Yeah, this does in fact, this is in fact exactly where it would have been. And it is in fact fronting nothing but the railroad track. That's true.
See if we can find an actual address on this place.
Yeah. Okay.
And what's the name of the street again? It's
this
Seeley?
Is Seeley Avenue now. Now, most of the time when you come to a road at all between Damon
Field,
and Hoyne, it is actually called...
Company.
Okay. Field Tool and Supply. It was certainly on the right spot. I don't know how much of the original building would have been incorporated into it. But, we're 65 Sobieski ought to be. Sobieski is what they called this section of Seeley Avenue.
Now, just to let you
time.
Know, what year was it that the streets changed?
That one we're not really sure. It was called Sobieski on the 1892 map. It was Sobieski in the 1895 newspaper articles. But then by the 1897 maps, it had changed.
Right. In fact, the street numbers had changed. That's actually, yeah. That was 1909?
1909, there was a major street renumbering. This is the 2300 block.
2358 North Seeley Avenue.
But also, we are also right near another thing that I checked up. Is funnily enough, this is like the most serendipitous thing of all, is we are right near where our tour actually runs. We're right between the Virgin Mary Salt Stain and the Liars Club. So if anybody out there is into ley lines, this might be especially interesting. But
actually, I know where the ley lines are in Chicago. This ain't one of them.
Okay. I'll take your word for it there. But, where was I? I'm still thinking about all the snow in my ass. But, anyway, the Liars Club is located at, I think, 1665 West Fullerton. Prior to the renumbering, that was 49 Fullerton. Right. Prior to the renumbering, so we can, but yeah, by the time of the renumbering, it was they had already changed the name to Seeley Avenue, so we're not really sure what the number would have been at the time. But this is exactly the right place. This is exactly where 65 Seeley would have been.
Well, we're fortunate that Adam had actually found the description that was
identified this,
the railroad tracks as a landmark that still exists to this very day.
Right.
So much of Chicago changes, even from year to year, that defines something that's well over 100 years old.
Yeah, I'm sure they've replaced the tracks, but they're in exactly
absolutely
the same place.
The track lines
running
along,
parallel
yeah
to the Kennedy Expressway.
There would have been no reason for them to replace the track right lines themselves.
And then we're walking along, and see, there's some other candidates for the building. Check out this really old-looking one right over here.
It wouldn't have been on the right part of the street. It would have been over there.
True. Well, it's going to be northwest of where the railroad track crosses Damon Street. So it's somewhere in this general vicinity, this general triangle.
Northwest of Damon or northwest
northwest
of Seeley?
Northwest of where it crosses Damon.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it could also be...
Oh, you're right, because you said northwest of where it crosses Roby Avenue.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a look around here. We're going to take a look
yeah
around.
Yeah, I'm not
candidates
totally sold on what that on that other building.
Okay.
It looks a little too nice, honestly. But, yeah, obviously it would have been way redone. But, yeah, what we're looking for is there was a 20-foot by 150-foot one-story structure. It was described as cheaply built even at the time. So
now,
it's
the only one from that era that I can see around here is the building straight
yeah
ahead
straight
of
in
us
front of us. There's an old brick building,
and that would be the only one from well, or this one right here actually.
Yeah, this one's also about that old, but that's more
that's
than two and a half stories.
Have, this is from the original period.
Yeah,
that's from the original period. That if it was at the location where we originally thought the Tool and Die place was,
but this is this is a 3.5-story place right here, though. So that doesn't match the description, because it was attached to a 2.5-story house. And there's a light
but
that's flickering
would have been
eerily.
In front, though. That's what they said.
Right.
Factory in front, 2.5-story behind. So that
yeah
would put it over here.
Uh-huh.
This could be it. This could be the only spot if it's
yeah
here today.
Or this is, or either of these could actually be the house.
Go ahead and look around the front.
Yeah. Yeah, this... You know, this here, I don't even know where this
no,
house
it
goes.
It could have been the house if it was over there, because that's Damon Street right there. The factory
right
would have had to have been here. And it was behind the factory where the glass
right
place was. This would have been here, and this could have been a factory. This may have been a glass blowing factory back in the day.
Yeah.
Let's go around to the front and see.
Yeah, let's see what we can look at there. Stuff's difficult to tell sometimes, you know. Things have been rehabbed so many times. The bricks have been retuck pointed over and over again in some cases. It could also have been right here where this parking lot is now. It would help if we could find, like, the initials HH scrawled on the ground or something. But
so
know,
one of the problems
that kind of
that
thing
we're
never happens.
Is at least we know we're in the general vicinity
right
of where the place is located. It's quite unlikely that any of the original structures are here today.
Right.
And we wanted to bring you guys along just to show you the process of what we go through, because Adam has done so much research on all of this. And he found the general location, and then I knew this neighborhood fairly well because I had lived here for
right
for quite a period of time. So between the two of us, we knew generally where we were going. But there's probably, I want to say, half a dozen places where it could have been.
Yeah, look at this place. This place is old and was certainly a factory at one point. We can tell by the smokestack. It's also just northwest of where the railroad track crosses.
That's, yeah, but the entrance to that place is on Fullerton.
Yeah.
That would have been around at the time.
But, well, the entrance is on Fullerton now. Who knows where it would have been at the time. Well, no, actually, that's a little too far away to have been on Sabisky, yeah.
Fullerton was here at that time, wasn't it?
Right, Fullerton was here at the time.
So that would have been in Fullerton. So
yeah.
That would not have been the building.
Right. Even if it, the entrance had been on the
even
back,
the
that wouldn't
again.
That would even if the entrance had been at the back, this wouldn't have been Sobieski.
So it's north and west of the railroad lines.
No, it's impossible. It's possible that the house itself is on would have been on Roby or Damon.
Yeah, because it said that it was on. It was behind the. Because you said it was.
Yeah, the factory is behind the house.
Behind the house.
And exactly how they were attached, it's very vague about.
So it could have been on Damon. You're right.
Yeah, the house itself could have been on Damon or Roby at the time.
Because I'm assuming that the factory was here. You're right, Adam.
And the factory might have
the factory would have been on what is
faced the other direction.
And it's either that factory that we had originally seen or one of the buildings that's opposite of it.
Yeah.
The house would be on Damon or it would have been where the car wash is.
Right. Yeah, the thing, the description we found of the thing is really very vague. In fact, the New York Times didn't even get the street name right.
No.
Now, this was the place that was too tall. That one's four stories.
Yeah.
This one also is certainly old enough. This was
considered 2.5 stories at the time.
It could have been, yeah. This is...
These are new buildings, so it wouldn't have been this one. Well, let's take a look at the addresses here, and then we'll do research.
2340 North Damon and 2342. So we'll check that on the renumbering and stuff. The renumbering on Damon wasn't particularly different. It would have just been about 200 off.
Only 200?
Just a couple of hundred, yeah.
1400 off?
Well, it depends on what the street was. Because Sobieski was such a short street, it probably had a numbering system unto itself. It's only about a quarter mile long road. Right.
Because most of the places around here were more than likely, from my knowledge of this neighborhood, built in the 1880s.
Right. This is the right time period for it. Let's get up as close as we can to the railroad tracks and see if there's a house right there. There's actually, we've got this, there's this one right here that I thought it might have been before. This one is also 2332. This one is just about an even 2.5 stories. Or they could have called it that at the time, anyway. Yeah. So, they certainly could have remodeled the building itself. This one, too, also looks...
No, because this had always been a garage.
Oh, yeah, you can see that. You can see where the bricks change color.
And this building is newer.
Yeah.
This is from the 40s, this building here, from here over. Although it looks a little bit older, the style of brick and the facade that they're using.
Yeah,
this is
new, 40s
but,
at the earliest.
This is like 1940s, so our best candidates are these ones, probably this one right here.
Yeah, for the house that was connected to the factory, yeah.
Looking at the height of the buildings here and judging the general location, it's either at the parking lot at the car wash or it's at 2332 Damon.
Yeah.
So what we need to do is go down to City Hall and find out the actual dates that these buildings were constructed.
Right.
So that's what we're going to find out next. We'll follow that up in a future episode.
Check out the exposed brickwork on the inside of this place from what we can see. Well, I don't want to go poking around in this place, but, these things... They're obviously very old brick in here.
But we're actually wrapping up now.
All right.
This is Ken Melwinberg, Psychic Detective.
Adam Seltzer, Professional Smartass.
And this is Weird Chicago Radio, signing off.
All right, well, hold on just a minute there. We can't sign off just yet because I have to relate to you one more story of a thing that we found in that general location where we were investigating. See, Sobieski Street was the name of the road for a fairly short time. It was only about a quarter of a mile long and such an inconsequential street that it never even seemed to be mentioned in the Chicago Tribune, as far as I can tell from the archives. But while we were there, it hasn't been named that since about 1896, but while we were there, there was a large billboard up for Sobieski Vodka, Czechoslovakian vodka. The sheer odds that the word Sobieski would appear so close to that street are probably so long as to be statistically impossible. I'm not saying there's anything occult, but it was awfully bizarre. Now, just to clear a couple of things up, no, the murder castle, the original one, did not burn down to the ground in 1895. In fact, it was still there up until 1938. At that time, there was a sign company and a used book and magazine store operating out of the lower floors. And how'd you like to be a guy who bought a copy of Weird Tales out of that place? But it was at that point that they razed the building. The city bought it from an 88-year-old woman for about $60,000, razed it and put up a post office on the site. If you want to see the post office on one of our tours, we do offer special H.H. Holmes and World's Fair themed tours that you can check out on our webpage. Furthermore, also, one thing I do want to clear up is, yes, H.H. Holmes is rumored to have said that he was Jack the Ripper on the gallows. It's more notably a behavior attributed to a guy named Dr. Thomas Cream, who was another Chicago-area murderer, a poisoner, actually, but apparently it was really all the rage to say that you were Jack the Ripper on the gallows in those days. So we're not entirely sure if H.H. Holmes did that or not. There's a lot of things we're not really sure if he did. A lot of the stories about him just come from conjecture, and a lot of what he said about himself was a complete lie. But anyway, we do think we've pinpointed approximately the location of where the second murder castle actually was. And there must be something weird going on there for the word Sobieski to show back up there, quite by coincidence, I'm sure, after all of these years. Anyway, this is Weird Chicago Radio. I hope you will join us again next time.
And Radio Land, is your radio station playing enough of the room?